Mini episode 1845 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode 1845. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris here. With one of our great FDH Lounge dignitaries, my friend Tony Mazur, somebody that I go back to the old Sports Talk Network days with. And Tony is good for checking out any number of subjects with here, as evidenced by his own podcast, which we'll talk about here in a second. But always love to have him on to talk baseball. It's a great interest of Tony's and with mine. So an excellent person to talk to here at the 2025 MLB midseason point. So, Tony, thank you so much for being on. And, of course, we can see from your tag there, of course, your Patreon podcast. Good to have you on. And talk about your podcast as well before we get started.
Well, thank you for having me on, Rick. And I am wearing the Cobra t-shirt, which is Dave Parker's nickname. And yes, if you want to go back in time and watch or listen to, because I was only doing audio only at the time. It's weird. We don't do just straight audio anymore. Very strange.
Right.
I kind of hate it. I want to go back to the old days, but I guess I'm a boomer. But the Cobra, Dave Parker, put out a book in 2021. So if you want to go check out that podcast, I did one right when he had passed away about 2 weeks ago, where it was just a bonus episode. It was only a 20-minute phone call. But if you want a longer version of it, go back in the archives to 2021, where not only do I interview Dave Parker, but I interview a guy named Rick Morris, and we go over some of the best players who probably should be in the Hall of Fame and guys that made the Hall of Fame that probably shouldn't be in there. And so now there's a couple of names that have since been named to the Hall of Fame, including the aforementioned Cobra, the late Cobra, Dave Parker. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a really cool episode we did. And I figured I don't want to just put out a 20-minute podcast. I'm going to do one that's a little over an hour. So I had you on. So it turned into like an hour and a half podcast. So go check that out from the year of our Lord 2021.
Always love checking that out and being on with you. It's always a great privilege to be able to do that. Of course, the Check Your Brain podcast. Go find it, as they say, wherever you get your podcasts, right?
The podcatchers, I believe we call them now.
Okay, yeah. And of course, especially on Patreon, because that's where you can get the choicest cuts of beef, as it were, with the podcast. A chance to check out everything that's there. And like I said, it's always been a great honor and a lot of fun for me to have been on any of the times I've gotten a chance to sit in. And again, when I've been on there from time to time, we've ended up talking baseball. And I know you're, of course, one of the best folks to be able to talk baseball with. So this MLB season that we've got going on now, we are, of course, recording this right at the midseason point. And it is, it's been an interesting and a colorful season thus far. You've got some real Hindenburg stories out there, like the Atlanta Braves, the Baltimore Orioles, two teams that folks like myself thought were going to be destined for much greater things than what has happened this year. You've got some guys that have really kind of taken that burst into superstardom this year, whether it be PCA with the Cubs, whether it be the old Big Dumper with Seattle, continuing on his great season with the Home Run Derby win the other night. So any particular place you want to start, Tony? It's been a very, very interesting season. A lot of things we've expected, but a lot of things we haven't expected.
Well, let's start with what happened from when we're recording this the night before, which was
okay.
The All-Star game. And
boy.
Now we have watched, there's been a couple of ties in the All-Star game that have gone to extra innings and they've had to figure out. You've had, was Pete Rose in barreling into Ray Fosse? Was that extra innings or was that the ninth inning?
I think that was the ninth inning in 1970, okay. Before my time, but I think it was regulation.
And then it was, and then of course we remember from Pittsburgh at Three River Stadium when Moises Alou off Jason Bure hits the game winning double into the gap, scoring Tony Gwynn. And it was such a thrilling game, especially for, you know, you're getting the Baseball Network and ABC and NBC have come together, and you're going to, and the strike hit about a month later. But then there was another one about 8 years later in 2002, where there was a tie in the All-Star game. Again, thanks to another Cleveland player. This one was Omar Vizquel hitting a triple to tie the game. And then Bud Selig just says, we're going to call it a tie. And people were not very happy with it. And it took a big PR blow to it. So they said, well, what if there is a tie and it goes into extra innings, we run out of players? Well, they almost did in 2008 at Yankee Stadium, the final year of the old Yankee Stadium. And instead, they decide to do a home run derby swing off, which Kyle Schwarber ended up winning the MVP because why? Because they played home run derby. I don't know. Some people like it. Some people thought it was really interesting. But here's my thing.
Okay.
And before I get to the season that has been the first half right now, I hate the fact that the All-Star game in every sport means nothing anymore.
Right.
I hate it. And it will segue into something I want to talk about that you and I kind of hinted at before we started recording. The All-Star game, as a child, for both of us and for all of us listening, the All-Star game meant we're in midsummer. So if there are things that when you're a kid that you haven't done yet during the summer, go to the beach, hang out with your friends. Now is probably a good time because you're at the halfway point in the baseball season and you have half the summer left to try to cram everything in before you got to go back to school. Then the back to school shopping commercials and start popping up and everything. So it was always that seminal moment in midsummer, literally, that you're going, this really is it. But if there's a time to just put it all aside and you don't have baseball or whatever you're doing on a Tuesday, you watch the All-Star game and you see players that you've only heard about from sporting news, from maybe ESPN, something in the newspaper, or you got some Tops or Upper Deck trading cards. You're like, oh, this guy's interesting. I haven't really watched him. But now that you have interleague play, and not only just interleague play where it's a couple of weeks in early June, it's spread throughout the year, so it means absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Now, the National League is no different from the American League. Even if the National League is doing better in the standings overall, National League and American League, they have the designated hitter. We still have this ridiculous put a ghost runner on second base or in extra innings thing.
Yeah.
There is no difference between the leagues anymore, and I hate it. I love the days of Whitey Ball, Whitey Herzog with Willie McGee and Ozzie Smith, where you're bunting on that AstroTurf, and it was like the American League has Earl Weaver and the three-run homer and the designated hitter, and the National League are, these are quick teams. Guys are stealing 80 to 100 bases on AstroTurf, and now it doesn't really mean anything. The All-Star game means nothing. Interleague play means nothing. It's just all what's the point of divisions? Because some teams are playing outside of a time zone. It doesn't really matter. So I guess long rant short here, my feelings on the first half of the season are not so much the first half of the baseball season. It's basically my problem with the Rob Manfred era of baseball in general.
Yeah, no, and you make very good points there on a number of different topics. And, I mean, just the whole de-evolution of this. I think, and I'm just going to kind of extrapolate a little bit here. I think we're meant to think of the way that the All-Star game ended as far as how they do it in soccer and in hockey with the shootouts. I mean, I think that's kind of what they were going for there, that sometimes shootouts will be the tiebreaker. But, you know, connoisseurs of those sports will tell you that that's not necessarily the most indicative way of trying to end a game as far as who the most deserving winner is. But, yeah, I mean, the gimmickization of the All-Star game, you know, I completely agree with that. And the whole thing, too, of like, this is like one of the most get off my lawn things that I could ever say. So I know you're going to love this, but it's like, why don't you just call it the American Conference and the National Conference? Because it used to be when you were talking of the leagues, you meant the American League or the National League. And like, I swear, Tony, I don't think I ever heard the abbreviation MLB until like the late 90s. And then it became ubiquitous. But it's like, it's at the point now where like nothing matters anymore. You're right. There are no distinctions. There's no distinctions in terms of styles of play. There's no distinction in terms of rules. The DH was the last distinction that there was. That became universalized. So, yeah, I mean, everything with Manfred. The one thing that I will say is that like with the pitch clock and some of the things they've done like that, while it does offend the old school person in me, it is one of these things where, again, generations even younger than you, they disdain baseball. It's too slow of a game. It's for old people. So, I mean, I think they have succeeded in the watchability as far as hiking it a little bit with the pitch clock and that kind of stuff. And that has offset the damage done to watchability that has been done by analytics, because everything with like, you know, the uppercut swing and everything like that, that analytics has dictated, that I understand why teams are going with it. It's not the responsibility of managers to worry about the watchability of baseball. And it really drove the watchability into the toilet with the games being that much longer, the whole specialization with pitchers going to the most ridiculous extremes. So the minimum amounts that pitchers must face in terms of batters, the pitch clock, et cetera, in some ways, these are abominations if you're thinking, you know, the purity of the game and Abner Doubleday and all that kind of stuff. On the other hand, it does make it more watchable than it was a couple of years ago. And I do appreciate that minor thing. And I do acknowledge that, again, the younger generations that think that baseball is just for, you know, old white people, you know, it is potentially, you see in terms of the ratings and that kind of stuff, it is having some kind of success there at least.
Though I did hear in it, because I'm like, okay, the pitch clock, there are a couple of things where I'm like, yeah, you're not going to fight City Hall anymore. Okay, they're going to put netting throughout the whole stadium because too many people are scrolling through TikTok and Instagram during the games, that they're not paying 100% attention to the game. Just because I am doesn't mean, you know, Aiden over in section, you know, 132 is paying attention. So
right.
I guess we have to fence in the stadium like a zoo. However, with the pitch clock, I don't mind it as a viewer. I go, okay, yeah, they got to get on the mound or otherwise it's a balk, or I mean a walk. However, I did hear somebody say that it might be contributing to arm injuries, because now guys cannot get into a rhythm and now they have to get basically right on the mound and just start firing.
Okay.
And I would like to see over the course of a couple of years, when this, now that this pitch clock is being taken seriously, if it has indeed contributed to the pitch clock or to the arm injuries, because I mean, you got to have a control with a study, you know, we've kind of learned that over the last 5 years with Follow the Science. I would like to see a little bit more data, but it's, I as a guy who used to pitch, I pitched in high school, I pitched outside of high school as well, that yeah, some guys, I was a guy, I wasn't a hard thrower, so I wanted to get right back on the mound and start throwing. The games I would pitch would go pretty quick, but other guys, they would take their time. They would be a Mike Hargrove on the mound, a human rain delay. Mm-hmm. But some players, some pitchers have to get in a certain rhythm. And if they're going up there and they're out of rhythm and they have to just start slinging the ball, that could be contributing to something. I don't know. I'd like to see this in the next couple of years, because as we know that the Tommy John surgeries that have skyrocketed in recent times plays into this, which actually gets into my next thing I wanted to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good segue that not only are, again, I hate saying get off my lawn, I'm an old boomer, whatever, but I remember when we were growing up, you'd have a couple of those anomalies where you would have a pitcher throwing 100 miles an hour and you're like, whoa, blazing fastball. But most of the hard throwers were throwing 96. When Rob Dibble's on the mound with the Nasty Boys, you're like, man, this guy just threw that ball 97 miles an hour. Today, 97 miles an hour, scouts aren't even looking at you because you're not throwing 100 miles an hour.
That's a changeup.
Yeah, exactly. And every single right-handed pitcher is throwing over 100 now. And then you wonder, gosh, wow, this guy just had two Tommy John surgeries when he was in college. What makes you think he's not going to need a third and have any tendons left in his elbow? And I don't know. It just, is this good for the game? Greg Maddux is in the Hall of Fame right now. Is it because he threw 102? No. Greg Maddux never even, I don't even think he ever hit 95. It was about location. But I guess in today's sport, it's screw location. Just throw the ball hard.
Yeah, and I tell you what, I'm going to connect the dots on the last two things you said there, Tony. And this is the kind of stuff I love. I love we can get really deep into this kind of stuff and make some good points on the show here, because it is a thing where we are living in Rob Nen's world, essentially, today. Okay, as far as going triple digits, it's the expectation of just about every frontline starter, of closers, of even elite setup guys here. And I trace this back to, in part, the 2014 World Champions, the Kansas City Royals, where they were like, well, we have Johnny Cueto and a bunch of average starting pitchers. But you know what? If we get a lead after six innings, forget about it, because we're just going to put the hardest throwers we got in there, seventh, eighth, and ninth inning. And this specialization now where, and again, you're only expected to go five innings in a game here at this point, twice through the order. I'm actually in a 20-team keeper league where starting next year, we're not even going to have wins as a category. They switched it to, and I don't know if this is the best idea, but the league decided to do it, switching to quality starts. Because wins are just like, you know, that's not even a gauge of anything anymore. You can be a great pitcher, but it's like if you got a crappy bullpen and you're only in there, they only let you go twice through the order.
I will say it's interesting you mentioned wins, because I watch a lot of YouTube videos of John Boy and all those other like newer Zoomers who are into baseball, and they talk about all these stats that I had never heard of until 5 minutes ago. They will go back in time and say, well, this guy led the league in wins with 21, but we don't gauge that anymore. But I'm thinking to myself, I understand that if a guy has a 6 ERA, but he won 23 games, that in 1984, they're going to say, yeah, of course, he's our Cy Young Award winner. I understand not gauging strictly by wins, but I don't know, isn't there some merit to it that you played on a good enough team, you pitched long enough into the game, and instead, we're just get me through a couple innings and we're going to go right to the bullpen and we're going to throw 82 arms out there, making sure that the game is done. It's unreal.
And that's where, and I think, like I said, it's the combination of the last 2 points you made, I think, that's contributing to the arm damage, because I hadn't really thought about the pitch clock in there, but that makes sense. But it's also a thing where, again, from what you talked about, the kind of pitcher that you were, okay, so you weren't going to have the mandate out there, just throw as hard as you can every time. But like right now, you know, if you've got that Rob Nen arm, they don't want any kind of like, don't worry about the changeups or the curveballs as much. Just pound it as hard as you can for as long as you can. And that's the whole thing. And if you've got guys in there, and if you've got a bullpen of guys that could really light up the speed guns too, you're just going with the hard cheese as much of the game as you can. That's the way that it's going with a lot of these teams right now. That's another function of analytics here, is to try to get the most out of your guys in that kind of sense. And that's where I hadn't thought about that in conjunction with the pitch clock. But yeah, I mean, if the mandate is, and it really seems to be, you know, that if you can really light up the speed gun, you need to do it as often as possible. The combination of that with, you know, you can't stand there too long, you can't sit too long, you can't give your arm, you know, any kind of, you know, really time between pitches, that for as much as it's helping the watchability of the game, yeah, then it would be doing a lot more harm than good if it is contributing to this epidemic of Tommy John surgeries.
What happened? We broadcast, we're from the Northeast Ohio area, so we've been known to have closers that would throw junk balls. Does that term even exist anymore? The old junk ball pitcher. Oh, Doug Jones has taken the mound, and he throws that fastball at 81 miles an hour, but he relies on his junk. Bob Wickman, Joe Borowski. We used to have knuckleball pitchers. You had the Necro brothers. You had Charlie Huff. You had Tim Wakefield. And what was Tim Wakefield? Tim Wakefield was a failed infielder who decided, hey, I can't throw the ball 95 miles an hour, but if I throw a knuckleball, maybe it can extend my career a couple of years. And what'd it do? He was in the league for 20. Yeah. So it was a way to try to say, look, I got to save face now. I got to try and get back. But what's happening now is that mindset has been taken up by failed outfielders who are learning to pitch.
Mm-hmm.
They all, while Rick Ankiel did the opposite, he was a pitcher who learned to become an outfielder because he could hit the crap out of the ball. Now you're seeing these Anthony Ghost, Tyler Naquin, some of these other failed position players say, well, I used to throw the ball pretty hard when I was playing center field. Why not try to go in the minor leagues and reinvent my career? Which I think is a great story, but it goes along with, so you can throw hard. It's still about location. Just right. Because you can throw 100 miles an hour doesn't mean that somebody isn't able to try to connect and hit the ball 500 feet into the third deck because you threw it right down the middle. And that's one of the issues. And that gets to my next point here. I know it's your show, but the approach to hitting is just it's atrocious.
Yeah,
it is absolutely atrocious. I see some of the old timer players, and again, it's like, oh, you're what do you know, old man? When I'm seeing Will the Thrill Clark and others are saying, this is your approach at the plate is it's stunningly bad that we decided because launch angle, you got to put the ball in the air, and that's all that matters. No, that's not all that matters.
Right.
So what happened to Wade Boggs? What happened to Ichiro, Tony Gwynn, Pete Rose, Rod Carew? These guys are all in the Pete Rose will be in the Hall of Fame, but all those guys are Hall of Famers, not for their long, 500-foot home runs, but they found a hole and put it somewhere. Mm-hmm. Now, the criticism whenever the pushback, I should say, when I bring that up, everyone says, well, guys are just throwing too hard. They're throwing too hard and you can't go opposite field. I'm like, are you out of your mind? That's the best time to go opposite field. If a guy's throwing 100 and you're late on a swing, you hit it down the left field line. Instead, now we have to manipulate the rules because the batting averages got so bad that if there's a guy who pulls the ball every time and every infielder is on the right side of the infield and he keeps hitting into the shift, instead of him saying, gosh, why am I not hitting opposite field? He's like, it's not fair. It's not fair. There shouldn't be a shift. So they had to change the rules because of how bad the batting averages were because the poor approach to the plate.
Yeah. And that's very shameful on the part of baseball. And again, that you had basically like a generation of players almost that were coming up since, and it was Joe Maddon, right around the end of the 2000s, beginning of the 2010s, starting to popularize the shift, and then everyone was doing it. But it's one of those things where it was a failure over a period of time consistently. Like, what other sport has had to do anything like that? Like in basketball, they're talking about moving the three-point line out to the sidelines and taking away the corner three because players are too good at exploiting it and the scores are too high because players could make that shot. In other sports, Tony, they're changing the rules because specialization has allowed players to become too good at something.
Go check out my podcast for folks out there with the great Ben Chu. You might have heard of him. He might be involved with FDH.
We
talked about all the analytics and the way the game has changed with that. And with baseball, we still have fences that are 395 to center field, where we have guys that are in as good a shape as they've ever been, including the steroid era. And you have baseballs that have been tampered with over time, ever since Major League Baseball bought Rawlings. This has been, there's so many scandals on scandals on scandals that really, unless you're paying attention, it's so hush hush in baseball. Mm-hmm. And But getting back to the hitting, I'm looking here at the midseason stats right now. There are 7 players above 300.
Yeah.
7 that are hitting 300 or above. And again, we're going back in time. We were in the Wayback Machine with Mr. Peabody and Sherman here. But when I'm looking, because you get to the All-Star game and they show like the All-Star games of the past and Larry Walker and Gary Sheffield and these guys, some of these guys who weren't even a Hall of Famers they're hitting 363 at the break, tied for 8th in the league. 363 at the midway point. 363 right now would be number 1 in the league. But back in those days, it was even guys like Jose Canseco were still hitting 300. Even the big steroided guys, they weren't hitting 190. They weren't Rob Deere. They were in the All-Star game, not because they have 30 home runs and 100 RBIs, but they're also hitting 320. Right now, there are, let's see, 5 players hitting 320 or above.
Yeah.
At the midseason point. And my guess, by season's end, it'll probably be half of that. You're probably going to see a total of 6 players maybe hitting at or above 300. And nobody seems to have an issue with it unless you're a baseball purist.
Well, yeah. And then all the teams out there, like, unfortunately, our hometown team, the Tribe here, where the ownership just takes the revenue sharing money and puts it right in their pocket and doesn't do crap with it, which is something I've been screaming about literally since the Dolans bought the team in the early 2000s. I mean, I was screaming about this predating my time at the Sports Talk Network, where I screamed about it constantly there. And it was a week ago Sunday when I was down there. They were actually giving away these handy dandy Tribe themed Hawaiian shirts that day. So at least I got something out of it. Actually, I great seats, and I want to put over FDH Lounge dignitary John Adams. Great guy that he is. Lower first baseline, not too far from home plate. Me, Ron Glasnap, both treated by the great John Adams. Appreciated. The heat index was over 100 that day, so it was kind of brutal. But, like, being there, Austin Hedges coming up later in the game after he'd had a couple of weak ground outs, at one point batting 104. And it's like, if your batting average has the chance to equal the FM number of a chick rock station, you don't belong in a lineup, okay?
Well, at this point, because there was that one time where you just understood the backup catcher was probably going to play Sundays only and then maybe as a fill-in, and your second baseman was going to hit one home run a year and maybe 12 RBIs because you didn't have him out there to play, to be a big home run hitter. For every Ryan Sandberg, you were having a Tommy Herr. You were having a lot of these guys that they could put the ball in play. They play pretty well in the infield. You get them for their defense. But I guess they don't really care that much about defensive metrics when it comes to wins above replacement and all this other stuff.
Right.
Maybe they will be soon. But you're seeing a lot of guys that are really good at as infielders who are getting shipped off to place to place. Because it doesn't matter. They can win a gold glove. That doesn't really matter. Are you hitting 35 home runs for us?
Right.
Or how about the other one is that Luis Arias from San Diego. He's won a batting title 3 years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody hears about him because they say that he's not as valuable because he's not as big of a home run hitter.
Yeah.
Because he's not putting the ball 450 feet into the right center field stands, that he's doing what we mentioned about what Wade Boggs did, what Ichiro and what Tony Gwynn, finding a hole, put it. Oh, look, they're shading me this way. I'm going to hit it this way. That's mm-hmm. what Arias has been doing. And they're like, yeah, well, he's not really valuable. So what if he's hitting 353? Who really cares? And I'm like, I care. Am I the only one? Am I old time guy? I feel that the analytics has just taken over baseball and taken over the love, where it's made it. It's obviously baseball is a business, but it's made it way too business-like. And in my opinion, these Zoomers and a lot of people who are really into the stats,
mm-hmm.
stats should be for general managers to justify their salary. Stats should be for the Billy Beans and the Theo Epsteins of the world. Not for somebody from Fargo, North Dakota, who's just a huge baseball fan and plays Strat-O-Matic baseball. That's not your job to look at defensive runs saved and FWIP and BABIP and all these other silly stats. Where do they come from? Again, mm-hmm. it's just all that Moneyball stuff to justify why you can have teams like the A's and the team known as the Indians and the Pirates justify to not pay certain players so they don't have to give them a big salary.
Yeah. No, and that's definitely the case. And that you're seeing it all around baseball now. And that I was actually talking to FDH senior editor Jason Jones about this, as far as when we talk about this season, the historically bad year that his now hometown team, the Colorado Rockies, is having. And I said to him, and he was complaining about the ownership to me, and I said, absolutely, you have every right to do that. I said, that is one of those things where I said, I wonder if and it was interesting because as I'm going to stop myself here, that Jason of course, covering Colorado sports for Athlon Sports, noted that Colorado doesn't actually have a baseball program right now, because I guess Coach Prime was getting the question on whether or not he would advocate to get one out there, to which the answer was no. But like, I'm questioning the whole thing now. Like, they've done what they can with the humidor. They've done what they can with the fence dimensions. But like, is it just that this is the worst organization in the history of baseball for developing pitchers? Or is it just completely futile to expect that that's ever going to happen? All I know is, like, in my long-term keeper league, I drafted Chase Dolander 2 years ago, like 2 months before the draft. I got him on like a 10-year deal in our keeper league. And as soon as I saw he was going to Colorado in the draft, I was like, no! Like, my Chase Dolander, you know, investment goes right down the crapper, just as happened with Riley Pint when I drafted him years ago. I think he was still in high school. He ends up going to Colorado, never amounts to crap. So it's like, I don't know. Do you have any kind of insight on that, Tony, of like, can you even play baseball in Colorado that resembles what we have in the other 49 states? Or is it just something where they ought to just pull the team out of there and, oh, by the way, find new ownership for wherever they go?
No, actually, it's kind of interesting that you say that. Is the Rockies are not last in attendance, I don't think.
Right, right. Because Jason said everybody regards it as, it's like the best bar in Denver. Like, just hang out.
Yeah. That's what it is, because Denver has become such a tourist place because of the marijuana and it's just, oh, Denver, it's like a new hippie haven. It's the new Austin. So they get people there because, yeah, it's the thing to do. We're already on Blake Street in downtown Denver just hanging out. And, oh, you know, hey, they got a hookah thing and maybe we'll drink some beers. They got a specials and everything. I guess there's a game going on, whatever. Or you're a transplant who's in Denver now, but you're from California and the Dodgers are in town. So you're going to go there wearing your Dodgers gear. And it's kind of like taken up where I think a lot of people figured Vegas was going to be, where it's a tourist town and you're not going there to see the home team. You're going there to see the team that, kind of like Florida. Florida teams where if you were going to Tropicana Field, obviously prior to 2024, to see the Rays, you weren't seeing the Rays. You were seeing the Red Sox play the Rays because you're from Boston. And that's what it was outside of maybe some choice teams like the Lightning have built up a nice following down there. Of course, your Dolphins and some others. But for the most part, baseball has not worked out in Florida. Now, in Pittsburgh, for example, it's like they don't care about the team. They know they're going to get the money from the revenue sharing. And what they're doing is they're selling their ballpark. Obviously, PNC Park is one of the nicest places in baseball. I'm going to be in Pittsburgh on Friday. Probably not go to a game, but I've been to that park many a time. I've worked there when I worked for Major League Baseball. It is so gorgeous. It's right on the Allegheny. You have the cityscape. It's only two levels, so there's really not a bad seat in the house.
Right.
The problem is the team has been terrible for their entire existence at PNC Park, save 2 years, 2013, 2015. Yep. That's been it. And it's like, hey, what about the team? And Pirate fans are like, sell the team. They got to get new owners. And they're not budging because they're getting the revenue sharing and they're using the stadium as public relations. Hey, come on over here, drink an Iron City beer. Hey, we have Primanti Brothers. You like French fries on your sandwich? Come on by. Hi, yes, what about the team? Well, have you seen the cityscape? That's the Penn Tower with the points on top of it. Yeah, I know, that's great. It's a really nice stadium. What about the team? Hey, you know, we had the All-Star game here in 2006. And hey, did you see the Bill Mazeroski statue and the Willie Stargell statue? Yeah, hi. But what about the team? They don't really care. And I don't think they care in Denver either. How is it that you have a team in Denver where it wasn't too long ago that you had Andres Galarraga and Todd Helton and Dante Bichette and Larry Walker and Vinny Castilla and Ellis Burks. These guys are hitting 40 home runs a year, and now you can't get anything going at that ballpark. It almost seems like they really don't. There's no push to get better in Colorado. They're just selling it as it's still one of the more quality baseball parks in baseball.
It is, and it's very interesting, too, and I really, 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 I respect the fans so much, and it hurts me to say that about any Pittsburgh franchise, but I do, because it's like, they're just fed up. Like, they're not going to take it anymore. Like, a city like Cleveland, it just hurts me that everyone is so malleable to the whole small market argument, that all the mouth breathers around here that it just, like, you know, and they're like, oh, actually the Josh Naylor trade was good because of the pitcher they got back. I'm like, why can't they be a team that tries to hang on to, a first baseman, or go sign a free agent first baseman to replace him and make a trade for a pitcher? Like, why can't you do both?
Why are the St. Louis Cardinals never the worst team in baseball?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's ownership, and everything else is just whining. It's just complaining. It's, oh, poor me, poor me. And anytime I hear about Moneyball, people should also remember, going back to the days of Moneyball, that they didn't win the World Series. They didn't go to the World Series. They didn't even go to the ALCS that year in 2002. Right. They had a nice run. They won 20 games. Scott Hatterberg gets the home run off Jason Grimsley. Oh, that's great. That's wonderful. And we have to hear about, well, actually, we don't need Jason Giambi on our team. If we bring Hatterberg and this guy and that guy, if we combine them in a platoon situation, their on-base percentage will equal a Jason Giambi for a fraction of the price. And what has it gotten them? What has it gotten Oakland A's? They're not even in Oakland anymore, first of all. Second, I think they made one ALCS and they got swept by the Tigers in 06, and they never came close to it. So that small market mindset, the Royals did that for a long time until they finally had a good core of guys and signed them to long-term deals, and they ended up going to two World Series, winning the final one.
Right.
But that's the only way those small market teams will win, is if you get young guys on the rookie contract. Otherwise, they're leaving. They're not going to stick around and take the – they're not going to take the – most players are not going to do the Jose Ramirez and take the hometown discount. Most of them will do what Moustakas did, what Eric Hosmer did going to San Diego. What happened with Eric Hosmer in San Diego? Nothing. No one ever heard from him. And he apparently retired a Red Sox. Who knew?
Right.
But he took the money. He did he'll probably have his number retired or his name in the Kansas City Royals Hall of Fame in a few years because of it. But – I think what happens is with these small market teams that they cry poor. It's still continuing to happen. And then the calls from the fan base are like, well, baseball needs a salary cap.
Yeah.
Then I don't know, get new owners. If you are not equipped to play in this game, if you are not equipped to be a business owner in this game, then maybe baseball is not the business you should be in.
Yeah, yeah. You know what the rules were when you got in. Nobody changed it up on you. Nobody made this something that you didn't think it was before. And that's where, again, all these other markets with the small market, with the fans, they don't seem to be as susceptible to the small market crap. All of the hipsters in Cleveland, but it goes deeper than that. And this has been the case going back to when you and I were at the Sports Talk Network. There were always people out there, any of the blogs that covered the local teams. There's this self-loathing cuck strain in the fan base. We don't deserve any better than this. Whatever the Dolans want to give us is good enough for us. Like, it's just, I come to expect that from everybody out there. And there was like one that I saw recently where it was like, you know, beating the drum, no pun intended, on sell the team. And it was an influencer that covers the Tribe. I think Gab Gowdy, I think so. Like, good for her. Cause like everybody else is so in the tank, and it's just in the media, any of the blogs covering the teams, any of the podcasts covering the teams. Like, I don't think you get that in other markets. And it's just, it's revolting.
Well,
all these people with Stockholm syndrome who don't think they deserve better. We do deserve better, Tony.
I remembered asking why Rex Ryan would go from being the head coach of the New York Jets to the Buffalo Bills. Now, he did nothing in Buffalo, but why would he take that job?
Yeah.
And it's because he knows that he can go into a market that is a small market that so many people are clamoring for access to the players, to the coaches, to the personnel, that they're not going to be asked the tough questions. And that's why he took that job. That's why Terry Francona went from Boston and the chicken and beer in the clubhouse to all of a sudden he comes to Cleveland and never gets a tough question asked at all.
Right.
And it's like this in a lot of different markets for people who want to know. Because when you're in New York, when you're in Boston, when you're in LA, of course you're gonna see a lot of this stuff happen. But there is a big push, especially with sports journalism, because ultimately sports doesn't mean anything at the end of the day. Maybe economically, when you look at that, but it's a diversion for most of us. It's a diversion. It's like, oh, my team lost. Gosh darn it! I hope they win tonight or the next game they play. But as far as integrity goes, and if you're a journalist and you believe in journalistic integrity, that it shouldn't be manipulated by the local beat writers because they don't want to lose out on their access to interviewing the manager of the team. And that happens in a lot of markets. And it's why you will get some teams that just play well enough to get to the playoffs. Cleveland does it. Tampa does it. I'm trying to think of other teams, but like they do. Toronto is a pretty good example of this, that they put so much into their ballpark. They have names of guys that you know because they're the kids of the players that you grew up with back in the day. But they do well enough to qualify. Seattle did this for how long? Seattle hasn't had a good team. They made one playoff appearance a couple of years ago, but I mean, they really haven't been anything since 2001 when they won 116 games. Right. So you will get some of these teams who are basically off the radar for the most part.
Arizona and Milwaukee do it too,
Yes, they just do enough to qualify, and that the way they sell it to the fan base is, all we have to do is at least make the wild card. And when we do that, anything goes. You never know what happens. The beauty of October baseball. Not exactly, because what happened last year? It was the Yankees versus the Dodgers. It was the two highest, the two biggest markets facing each other. What's it going to be this year? Probably the same. I wouldn't be surprised if it's the exact same repeat of a World Series in 2025 as it was in 24. So I'm sick of the crying poor. I'm sick of the public relations. I'm sick of that if you're critical of the team, you're afraid your credential is going to get revoked. Right. And this happens. And for people who listen outside of the bigger cities, this does happen. Like Russ Cohen, for example, has been around the biggest cities in this country covering NHL, MLB, NFL. You don't have to really worry about that because these coaches and these players expect the tough questions, but head on into the middle of the country and you're afraid if you're slightly critical in your question to the manager that you're afraid that they're going to say, we're going to have to see your credential. You have now lost access. You will never be able to be in this locker room again. Oh gosh, I don't want that. Well, you better play ball with us.
Yeah. That's what it comes down to with a lot of these, you know, crybabies that can't handle the tough questions. And I will say, as far as it goes with the World Series from last year, this was something that I had started to notice as we were heading towards the playoffs. And it was one of those things where, like, I just looked at it like, man, there are like six teams in the National League that could beat the ass of whoever comes out of the American League. And I was just, I'm not used to looking at it that way. I'm not used to looking at the American League as the NBA Eastern Conference, but it seems to have carried over into this year. I mean, Detroit, to me, they're the most legit team in the league, but I will tell you, I saw them when I was there on the day where I got this shirt. They didn't have Spencer Torkelson in the lineup. Kerry Carpenter is out hurt, which is killing one of my fantasy teams right now. And I'm trying to think, there was somebody else that was sitting, and it was like, this is still a lineup that's better than the pathetic Tribe, but like
they have some young players, but they just seem like a paper, no pun intended, a paper tiger.
Well, and that's it. Like, they're not as good as what their record shows. Are they the best team in the American League? I think they are. But, like, would I have any confidence in them to beat Philadelphia, to beat the Mets, even with some of the problems they've had this year, to beat the Cubs, maybe even the Brewers, certainly not the Dodgers, probably not the Padres. Like, I go down the National League, and there's any number of teams that I think can beat the best team coming out of the American League, because there were a lot of people that were kind of surprised, because if you just look at it on paper last year, like you said, top two payrolls. But if you looked at it, you're the kind of guy that's going to look at it the way I do. You look at the lineups, particularly you stack the lineups alongside each other. The pitching rotations were probably a little closer. But the lineups, that's one of those things where, and I remember saying this to Steve Callis when we did our playoff preview last year, you know, like, I'm not used to seeing as many American League, you know, lineups of teams that are in the playoffs, where I go back to the two Bobs from the movie Office Space, any number of guys in the lineup where you look at them like, what would you say you do here? And like, the National League just doesn't have that with their top teams. They don't have that many holes in the lineup relative to the American League. I mean, I'm painting with a broad brush, but it's also, I think, largely true. And I think it's likely to play its way out as we see, like, whoever comes out of the National League, I would think would be a substantial favorite in the World Series this year. And like, we're not used to being able to say that and make that kind of a broad generalization, but I think we can this year, just like last year.
Yeah, I'm looking here at the playoff scenario. There is only one team, and that's Tampa, who is the only team above 500 that is not qualifying for the playoffs right now. Every team else is not is below 500, but there's a lot of mediocre teams.
Yeah,
a lot of teams that just don't scare me. And it's interesting because when you talk about NBA and NFL, that if you tank with your season and you say, look, we're going to suck for luck. We're only going to, if we win a game this year, it's complete accident. It's because the other team's also trying to tank and it's going to be a bad, bad game. Don't even watch us this year because we're trying to get that number one overall pick. Same in the NBA. But that's because those prospects are basically whether you're coming out of college or what have you, you are ready and can make an impact almost immediately.
Yes.
That's not the case in baseball, that you are not doing a John Olerud. You're not doing a Todd Van Poppel type of situation where they're rushing you all the way to the major leagues. It's going to take a couple of years for you to get acclimated, that you're going to get drafted in 2025. Guarantee you, you're not going to see some of these guys until 28, 29, maybe. So, it's a long process. So in baseball, you really can't tank. If your record is that bad, then it's bad. I mean, it's not looking good for you to turn it around within a year. That's just not how it works. Unless your plan is to do a baseball version of Sam Hinkie and continually lose 120 games for 5 to 10 years in a row, you get the number one overall pick like the Rays did, and then have been fairly relevant ever since 2008. I don't know what the plan is, but there's just a lot of mediocre teams and very, very top heavy in that American League. And like you said, nobody really, really scares me all that much. That's why I keep looking at the Yankees just going, they're at this point time tested. And though the Tigers gave the team once known as the Indians a good run last year, I don't know. It just seems like they're kind of pretenders right now in that they need another bat or even two for me to go, okay, maybe they got something going here.
Yeah, and that's where, again, you look at it, and I was told coming out of the last CBA that this next thing I'm going to mention to pile onto what you just said there wouldn't be a factor anymore. But another thing is, if you're a prospect and you get drafted and you go to an organization like, let's say, Cleveland, for example, they will manipulate the fudge out of your service time so that they delay the clock on when you actually get paid. Because if you're any good, you'll only be there through the first contract anyways. I still have the conspiracy theory that the Tribe didn't want to draft Charlie Condon when they had the number one pick overall because they were afraid he was going to be like a 60 home run hitter and people would lynch the front office for getting rid of him at the end of his rookie contract. But again, these things come into play also too. And the landscape of where we're at midseason in 2025, somebody like David Sampson will say, and just because he's saying it and he's a little sensationalistic doesn't mean that it's not true, that we are headed for a probable lockout at the end of the 2026 season. And that's where, again, we've been kicking the can down the road for a quarter century at this point, because I go back as far as 9/11. There was going to be a lockout in the offseason after 2001, and they were going to address these issues. And it never happened. It was like, oh, well, you know, 9/11 happened. It has to be peace, love, and understanding. Let's paper this over. And it's
didn't they have like a 12-hour lockout in the middle of the 2002 season?
I don't know if it was then, but it was one of these subsequent ones. I do know that, like, in spring training, I think in one of these, maybe in the 2010s, I think they might have had a brief interruption during spring training. But it was
a couple of years ago in 22.
Yeah, and that's what I'm thinking of. And that's where it's like, unless anybody is willing to risk the carnage, unless the players are willing to risk the paychecks to keep the status quo, which basically, make no mistake about it, the players want the status quo because right now it's doing nothing but giving them everything they want. But the owners have been the ones that have wanted systemic change for over a quarter century. Quite frankly, I say 9/11, we could go back further to, you mentioned before, the strike of 94, 95. Nothing was ever settled coming out of that. And so this system that we have where, again, not to, you know, parrot the small market whiners talking about the disparities here, but of where you have had this whole thing of the big market teams, the small market teams. And I'll say that the small market owners are cynically exploiting, you know, that whole storyline to put as much, you know, cash in their own pocket as possible, but where we don't have a salary floor that would stop them from doing it. All these things, this has been 25 years, 30 years, whatever, in the making.
It's 50 years, if you think about it. Go back to Catfish Hunter. Go back to free agency.
Original free agency.
The 1981 strike, well, a lot of it was because you're seeing the Dave Winfields and the Reggie mm-hmm. Jacksons all go to the big markets and leaving little old San Diego and other players in Oakland in the dust, and they didn't know how to handle it. Then there's a mid-season strike that their first game back was the 1981 All-Star game.
Yeah,
and then what happened? They started causing this, and then they were giving boatloads of money and realizing, oh shoot, we're giving tons of money to these players. What's going on? So there was a collusion scandal that happened in 1987, which is why a lot of these free agents were sitting at home waiting for, like, hey, am I going to play? Tim Raines, Andre Dawson said, I'll play for free. Basically, give me a check for whatever the league minimum was. And then he ends up winning with incentives and he wins the MVP that year. But Kirk Gibson, that's why he was able to get out of Detroit and went out to the Dodgers in 1988 as compensation. But there were a lot of these. The owners created this. They created this madness, and then they've had to live in this. And now, I mean, think about Miguel Cabrera signed that massive deal with the Detroit Tigers. Yep. How much of his prime did you get out of that deal? 2 years? The rest of it was just watching him. Like, I don't even think he's going to make it to first base. And I'm noticing that outside of the Juan Soto's and the Bryce Harper's, that for the most part, some of these owners are like, guys, I don't know about these 10-year contracts anymore. Did Albert Pujols live up to his deal? Of course not. Robinson Cano live up to his deal? Of course not. Prince Fielder? No, he retired with a neck injury 5 years into his contract. The 10-year deals, I know what they were trying to do, but I don't think you go more than 3 or 4. And I think that maybe that's being righted right now, but it just seemed like you are strapping your team down. And then again, if you're a team that doesn't do a lot like the Mariners, you sign Robinson Cano to a 10-year deal. And then you're like, well, we can't afford any other players because we're paying this guy. And he's sitting on the bench because he has an 80-game substance abuse suspension right now.
Well, and as far as substance abuse suspensions and the like, I think that ties into what we're talking about here as well, because when you look at it, and right now it's only like the best of the best that are getting the 10-year and longer deals. They're the ones that are unmistakably the best players in baseball. You're not seeing that as much anymore. I was just talking about this with somebody the other day off air. I don't remember who, but talking about the whole thing of, like, once they started really doing the drug testing, and I was skeptical at the time. I'm like, they're just going to get designer HGH like a lot of the pro wrestlers, you know, have been able to get. But it looks like in baseball that hasn't been the case, because for the last 15 years plus, 15 to 20 years, however long it's been, you haven't had this whole thing. I remember the credulousness of the sports writers at the time, like in the late 90s, like, oh my God, players are now having a second prime in their late 30s. Science is a wonderful thing. Science is so amazing. How are these guys doing it? The credulousness of these morons who were just, probably they were knowingly propagating all of this anyways. But like, once you started cracking down on that stuff, Tony, I actually think maybe this is why we've had the uneasy labor peace as long as we have, because it would be so much worse for the owners if they were still having to factor in the whole quote unquote second prime stuff. Yeah. Now you're at least paying guys based on a predictable aging curve, and that has put a little bit more predictability back into the process. But that's where I think this has almost sort of become the frog in the pot of hot water that they don't realize it's boiling yet, because it's a thing where, you know, not having to factor in the whole second prime has made it a little bit easier for especially even the big market teams on this. And trust me, if the big market teams, if the teams like the Dodgers and the Yankees and the Mets, if they were squealing about the way the system is, we would have had this our labor Armageddon some time ago. But it's only like, again, we keep saying that, oh, next year, and that's going to be when it is. But like, I remember the time before, I think it was the 2022, like you said, the last CBA. I remember having Seth Everett on the show, I think ironically at the time of the All-Star break, we were talking about stuff, and he was just like, I don't know, man. I think the next time it's going to be it. And I was just like, they've been saying that, though. Like, the next time should be it. Like, they should figure out what the system is going to be for the next 50 years and then just go with it. But they've been kicking the can down the road every time. They settled it the last time, and I'm looking at the agreement, like, this does not substantially change the status quo. And I think the odds are that more likely than not, way more likely than not, whatever they come up with, Tony, it's going to be, they went through all of that to get this. This is just more status quo.
I have several thoughts I'm going to try to articulate right now. Okay. One of them being longevity. You're not seeing the longevity anymore, and I don't think you are going to see the longevity, because there was at one time where you would have those guys that were an all-star early on their career, and they kind of hung on, but they were valuable enough to keep on the roster.
Right.
And that's not like that anymore. You think Jamie Moyer pitched for, I think, 82 years.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie Moyer faced Steve Carlton in his first appearance back in 1986. And in his final appearance, I believe he was facing Giancarlo Stanton.
Wow.
And it's amazing how long he was on. But Jamie Moyer was never a fantastic pitcher. He had a nice second half. No one would ever accuse him of being on steroids, but he figured out how to pitch. But we're not giving guys enough of that time to try to learn things and maybe, who knows, learn a knuckleball or do something different. Kenny Lofton. We all love Kenny Lofton. Was my favorite player growing up. What hurt him, his Hall of Fame chances right now? My opinion is he bounced around from team to team to team. Because though 2005 Kenny Lofton wasn't as effective as 1995 Lofton, he was still effective in certain ways. But I guarantee you, Kenny Lofton would have been out of the league by about 2005 anyways, or he would have bounced around a little bit. Or Bartolo Colon towards the end, he really was just kind of a sideshow act. He was just this big fat guy who had a home run in San Diego.
Right.
I think what's going on is that you're seeing a lot of these players that they're going to try to hang on, but I guess their prime, if their prime isn't long enough, you're not going to see them around too much longer. Corey Kluber won two Cy Young Awards. He's been out of the league for a couple of years now because he had arm problems. So you think about what their peak is. And then I look at that as a Hall of Fame category. And one of my things has always been, not only did you have a pretty long peak, but were you in the league for a long time? That I'm not going to go after a guy who had three amazing years and then several mediocre. And I'm also not going to go after a guy to send to Cooperstown who had three amazing years and then retired the next year. It's not the NFL. You're not Terrell Davis. It should be a mix of, this guy made several All-Stars. He was an MVP or Cy Young Award winner. He did this. He had these lofty stats and he was in the league like 15, 20 years. And I don't think we're going to see that. And you're going to see guys that are going to get sent to the Hall of Fame in probably the next couple of decades that probably played maybe eight seasons and maybe four of them were pretty good. And it's watering down the product, as I always think about. Let's see, what else did I have on my list of more gripes that I had? The baseballs. From what I've heard now, every stadium has a humidor. So it's not just Coors Field. So I guess the contact, the BABIP type of thing is actually gone down and guys are not hitting the ball as far. Now, why is that? Is it because of the humidor? Possibly. Or is it because, again, like I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, MLB owns Rawlings now. MLB mm-hmm. owns the baseballs. Now, how is it in 2017 and 2019 that we far exceeded the home run rate? Is it because guys are learning to be keto, that they're eating, they're drinking their greens, and they have their pre-workout and their proteins? Or did they manipulate the baseballs? And it's pretty obvious they did. And it's right. pretty obvious that they pick and choose which baseballs. I guess there's three baseballs they use now. MLB's response is, well, no baseball is exactly alike. But why is it that Shohei Ohtani used one certain ball last year, whereas the Chicago White Sox were using a very different ball, a deadened ball last year? A Goldilocks ball is what they've said that they were using for a lot of Dodger games and for Yankee games for Aaron Judge's record in 2022.
Right.
So the baseballs are much different. Kind of reminds me again of 87, where they had the rabbit ball, where you're playing in mm-hmm. a dead ball decade, and all of a sudden you're having 29 players hit over 30 home runs. And then 1988, it's back to normal. Third gripe, and the biggest of all, is this gambling thing. And we have not heard a lot. They've been pretty hush-hush on this Luis Ortiz thing, who plays for the team once known as the Indians.
Yeah.
Now, for folks who didn't remember the story, because it was like a big story for an afternoon and no one's talked about it since, but he's been indefinitely suspended under a pending investigation.
Yeah.
It seems to us what happened is that they were investigating a couple of pitches that he had in recent games, where on the first pitch of the third inning, he threw a ball. But not just a ball. He spiked the ball.
Yep.
He threw the ball 50 feet. It's 60 feet, 6 inches. And he threw this ball right into the dirt, meaning he was intending to throw a ball. Now, is that because he's getting paid or all these other people are getting paid? That all of these... they were seeing an unusual amount of activity of people betting, not just on the game, but on individual pitches in a game, to say, hey, that first pitch in the third inning is going to be a ball. I'm putting $100 here. I'm putting two grand or whatever is going to be. And he throws not only a ball, but a horrible pitch that is nowhere close to the plate. And that makes me wonder, this can't be the only thing.
Right.
We can talk all day about steroids, but the thing with steroids or performance enhancers, HGH, is that you still had to go into the gym. You still had to work out. And that also didn't guarantee, it didn't help your eyesight, and it didn't guarantee that you were going to hit the ball 500 feet or hit 400 at the plate. It was just, yes, is it cheating? Is it competitive advantage? Whatever you want to call it, sure. But did it harm the integrity of the game? We can make an argument for it. But you have to at least put in that work. When it comes to gambling and the integrity, if we're betting on individual pitches, and if the pitcher knows he's being tipped off that he has to throw these certain pitches, and then you see other things. I was watching this with the missus. We were watching a game recently, and we were talking about this case. I think it was the day that Ortiz got suspended. Mm-hmm. I said, what about the batters then? That a batter's up there, and a ball is 5 feet outside, yet he's swinging at it. There's no one on base. It's not like it's a hit and run situation. So maybe that the batter got tipped off that, hey, I'm up there. The first pitch is going to be a strike no matter what. So the guy throws it way outside and he swings at it. Mm-hmm. And we were watching. It was the Cubs were playing, and it was a pitch that was 3 feet outside and the guy swung at it. And I'm going, that right there makes me seem like it's, as the kids would say, sus. That I'm looking at that going, maybe he had money on it. And that's when you start to really go, what's going to get done here? Are we going to have to really go through it with a fine-tooth comb at every game and wonder if this is happening? And will MLB actually dedicate themselves to an honest and fair investigation on this? Mm-hmm. Like they did with the Astros? Oh, wait, no, they didn't. They didn't do any of that. Now, why did they do that? Probably because MLB found out that every team is cheating. That it wasn't just the Astros banging on trash cans and having electronic buzzers on chests and that kind of stuff. I think MLB found out that every team was doing it. So I'm wondering if every team has at least one player who is in the throes of this degenerate gambling that we are dealing with and that's being normalized in our society, that I wouldn't be surprised if every team has a player that has been fixing games that way. And again, I wonder why it took Pete Rose all this time.
Yeah, I very, very possibly. And it's one of those things, too, where, again, and I've talked about this with some of my friends that, like, you know, growing up in the 80s, like all these things. I mean, you could look at it through the prism of sports. You could look at it through the prism of society, whatever you want to look at it through the prism of. But all these different, moral ills, as they were always, called back then. Many are now legal, accepted, whatever, by whether it be the sports entities, governments, etc., because they realized how much money there is in that. Like, oh, you didn't tell us there was this much money that was involved in this. Like, yeah, like, where does the Pete Rose estate go to get its apology for this? The fact that there's, I think the Great American Ballpark or whatever they call it now has a casino in it. Are you kidding me? You're the folks that banished Pete Rose. Where does Willie Mays, in my estimation, the greatest player of all time, where does his estate go to get their restitution? This man was banned from baseball in the 80s because he was a greeter at a casino.
Yeah,
because
Mickey
he
Mantle.
Dared to play in a – yeah. Like, these guys played in a time and an age where they didn't make this insane amount of money, where the owners were able to restrain the salaries successfully. And then when they're trying to fend for themselves in their old age to provide for their families
– How about Shoeless Joe and Eddie Seacott in the 1919 White Sox? I mean, yeah. It gets to a point where – gambling in baseball has been around since the very beginning. Probably it predates baseball as far as gambling on sports and whatever. This has been going on. I'm not justifying it. In fact, I think it's reprehensible that for all this time we have to have Jim Gray on the field at the 1999 All-Star Game saying, "Hey, Pete, come on, just admit it that you bet on baseball. Jim, we're here for celebrations, the all-century team. But come on, you just say it. You know you bet on baseball. Piece of garbage, Jim Gray." But anyways.
Makes everything about himself.
Yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
It's like listening to Jim Nance at the end of a golf tournament. Like, what catchphrase is he going to use to get himself over?
the whole thing of – and look, Pete Rose made a lot of money on this and in playing a victim, which is whatever. He did it. He bet on his team. But he bet on his team to win. It wasn't this situation where you could very well have guys that are actively throwing games because they associates of theirs have a lot of money riding if on certain pitches. Again, it's not even betting the outcome, betting the over under. It's now betting on individual pitches. This is as absurd as betting on which color Gatorade is going to be dunked on the winning Super Bowl coach.
Right.
That's a prop bet, and that's silly, or how long the national anthem is going to take. But when we're going through individual pitches and putting large sums of money on just one pitch.
Yeah.
I think we have jumped the chasm here, and I don't know how you root this out. The other leagues are dealing with this right now. You get Terry Rozier, you get a couple of those basketball players, like you need to have a certain amount of turnovers and the guy throws a horrible pass that you and I could complete and it gets taken for a turnover. You're like, oh yeah, clearly this guy's throwing the game because he has gambling debts or whatever, he's indebted to somebody else. Baseball is one where we've heard our entire lives about the integrity of the game, and yet when this comes out, we don't hear anything about it. We don't hear anything about that this could have potentially been a problem, and yet now, again, the toothpaste is out of the tube. Every stadium has a sports book, and it's brought to you by BetMGM and FanDuel and this and that. And the pre and post game shows are brought to you by the local casino. It's getting bad. It's getting bad, and MLB is just raking in cash. I guess it's just their way. Have you noticed, by the way? I remember watching Major League 2, and the big joke was that Roger Dorn didn't have enough money to make payroll, so he sold the outfield, to which Bob Uecker, Harry Doyle said that it looks like the yellow pages in the outfield. Well, now every stadium's entire outfield walls are covered in ads. So now the foul poles are covered in ads. The jerseys are covered in ads. The bases have ads on them. The mound has an ad on it. Inning. We want to talk about integrity of the game. There is no integrity anymore.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Well, also, too, I mean, you talk about the bases. I mean, since you've basically enlarged them to the size of pizza boxes, you might as well just sell the rights to pizza companies and get it over with, you know, because that would be very fitting. But as far as it goes with all of this stuff and with the gambling, like, again, guys like me and you are old enough, you probably just barely, to remember when the only prop bets every year happened during the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And but even then, I got it into my head, like, anything that can be controlled by any one person is inherently going to be hinky as far as putting a bet down on. Well, I was joking about this recently with my best friend, who is a very, very, you know, avid gambler, more or less retired gambler. But, like, we were laughing about this. So, like, one of the original prop bets was, I think in my estimation, the greatest sports writer of all time, Dr. Z. Paul Zimmerman from Sports Illustrated, he would always write every year and covering the Super Bowl. One of his things would be about timing the national anthem. And that was one of the original prop bets out there. Will it go over or under a certain amount? My best friend and I were laughing about this, like, man, if I was singing the national anthem at the Super Bowl, first of all, as if, but if I was, I'd be slapping down everything I owned on the over and then be like, oh, say, can you see? Like, how can you let something be in the hands of one person? And that's exactly what we've got now. But like you said, Tony, it happens thousands of times, probably a night in America, in various sporting events. Yeah, is the first pitch going to be a ball or a strike? Although I never stopped to think about it, that like Ortiz putting the ball in the dirt, he would have been screwed, allegedly, if somebody had taken a swing at it anyways. If somebody had conversely bet that it will be a strike no matter what. I hadn't thought about that part of it here. But it's like anything that is inherently in the hands of one person, you have this kind of larceny that is available to be had. And the thing is that baseball for decades and decades and decades warned about this. Until they saw how much loot was at stake, when they were like, oh, I'm sure we can handle it. We can police ourselves. And you're seeing now that they can't. And we knew all along that they couldn't. They were right all the time back in the day when they were warning about the evils of gambling. Like I said, taking it too far when Mays and Mantle, the retired players, are working for a casino and they're not working in baseball in any kind of, they're not coaches or GMs or anything like that. That was shameful.
That was Bowie Kuhn, I think, did that.
Yes.
That
was, I mean, that was shameful what they did to the old timers back in the day, but they were broadly right about the evils of gambling and what it was going to do to the sport. But like now it's just one of those things where, again, they, and the fact that baseball all this period of time, basically the nose under the camel's tent here is because I've always said, and even with running fantasydrafthelp.com, I've always admitted the first cousin of gambling is fantasy sports. As soon as we started getting daily fantasy, I was like, this has obliterated whatever kind of distinction there is between gambling and fantasy sports. Daily fantasy was the ultimate merger of these things. And that then led to all the prop bets and everything else like that. So it's like, yeah, I mean, the corruption, it's right there. And it's like, there will always be the sacrificial lambs that they will put out there, like Luis Ortiz. And I don't say that with any sympathy for him, because he should be banned if he did it. And it sounds like they're well on their way to proving it. But it's like, they're gonna let you think it's just a stray here and there and whatever, when, like you said, it's probably extremely, extremely widespread, and that the sport has been compromised to degrees to which they'll never admit, and they'll try to cover up to make sure that the rest of us never find out how compromised it's become.
Well, when you mention about Mantle and Mays getting banned, because mm-hmm. in those days, yeah, you were Mickey Mantle, you were Willie Mays, you had endorsements and everything, but they weren't making the kind of money by a long shot.
Right.
I mean, those were guys, like, if you were a really good player, you in the off season would still go to banquets in Erie, Pennsylvania, and you go to random towns at some, and you would speak and you would sign autographs and whatever. And that would be a way to make money. A lot of guys up until the late 70s had a second job in the off season because they weren't getting paid that much money. They had to supplement their income. And then, you know, that's what ended up happening. And then there was a time where, because of how ubiquitous it is, you would have a bookie. Like, some guys would just be like, hey, I have a bookie and I meet him here. And then we go over a couple of things and fork over whatever money I owe or that I'm getting paid. And then now you're doing it from your phone. You don't have to go to Vegas. You don't have to go to Atlantic City.
Right.
You could sit on your sofa in anywhere America and bet on pitches and whatever. You could bet on if a guy's going to make this three-pointer or something. Mm-hmm. And that's where, when you think of the Ortiz thing, this is where maybe not everybody is wired this way, but I'm wired this way. I start looking at this going, we're not even close to finding out the, not just in baseball, because you think a quarterback, oh, misses a wide open receiver. Now, did he miss the wide open receiver because, I don't know, it slipped out of his hand? Or was there something a little more to it? So you start looking, if you're like me, I start looking at it through a different prism of, did he really mean to miss that receiver? Did he really mean to miss that wide open layup? Or mm-hmm. could there have been something that, hey, you're getting a buzz from somebody on the, in, you know, section 200 who has money on the game and who's your bookie said that this layup, you got to have the under, you were about to at least tie or push with 12 points and your average is this. So it just makes me look at the game different. And I hate that I do that, but it's just me now. Just like with the Astros thing. The Astros scandal, when everybody to this day still boos Altuve, still boos Springer, still boos Bregman and all these other guys who played on the team, fine. Fans can do whatever they want. But the fact that other teams did not join in on wanting more of a punishment than we're just going to fire the manager and the bench coach might not be able. And then, but no, they got really a slap on the wrist. And that's mm-hmm. because it seemed to me that every team in the league has some kind of technology that they are using to steal signs, whether it's the guy on second base that rubs his jersey or in the bullpen in center field, they picked up on a sign from the catcher that they buzzed and you have a little electronic buzzer on your chest to tell you, oh, he's going to throw a curveball here. Wait back. Don't overswing on this.
Right.
And it just makes it seem to me that other teams were doing this, which is why you didn't hear much of an uproar from the rest of the league.
Could very well be. Yeah, could be very widespread in that regard. And I'll just say, too, in terms of being widespread, this is one of these things where, I mean, if guys like me and you are thinking about it, then people who are in the business are thinking about this as well. Another thing that my best friend and I have laughed about over a period of time is the whatever sport you're talking about, whether it be the referees, umpires, whatever. Like, me and him have been like, do you realize how much money we could make as NBA refs? Like, are you threatening me? That's a T. You're getting in my face again. Second T, you're out of here. Like, it would be so easy to just, you know, you're probably doing it in less blatant ways, right? But like, it's so easy to jerk with it that way. Like, the fact that the widespread, the ubiquity of gambling being available out there, not just in baseball, but in other sports, the potential for any type of corruption is just, it's literally limitless at this point in time. And keep in mind the whole thing here too, the thing that made the most sense about Pete Rose's suspension from baseball, which again, Bart Giamatti, and this was pointed out by FDH Lounge dignitary Steve Callis, he never meant for that to compromise Rose's Hall of Fame eligibility. Those were supposed to be separate matters. You could be banned from working in baseball without being banned from the Hall of Fame. The writers interpreted it that way. But the thing that made the most sense about him being banned from baseball, I think Dan Patrick has made this point, the TV guy, not the lieutenant governor of Texas, about passively throwing games, right? That, like, if you're putting all the resources into this one game with the bullpen or whatever, and you're not going to do that tomorrow because you're not betting on tomorrow's game, then you are passively sort of corrupting the game by, as a gambler, making some games more important than other games, thereby corrupting, you know, the competitive integrity. We are seeing the game threatened in ways now substantially far beyond that, that make what Pete Rose did look absolutely quaint. And it's happening. It might be happening on a nightly basis, Tony Mazur.
Well, and let's take it to also in the 1980s, because it seemed like we were trying to, you know, in the decade of Miami Vice and the Cocaine Cowboys and Freeway Rick Ross, we're also saying, oh, you can't gamble. You're banned from the game. You're doing this, this, and this. Go over to football with the SMU scandal. Go over to basketball and college basketball with Tulane. Those are two programs that met the death penalty. The latter ended up having their basketball team completely taken away from them. Right. I mean, we saw it from John Hot Rod Williams, who got drafted by the Cavs. These were unbelievable scandals, and you were seeing how much corruption was going on behind the scenes. This corruption is wide out in the open. Yep. And it almost seems like we've been so normalized culturally that this happens, that younger generations just now they're growing up with this, and this is normal. This is abnormal. This is for people who want to really go back. If you're 18 years old and you hear about Pete Rose, who died almost a year ago, you say, why was he even banned then? What was the problem? And I'm like, well, yeah, that's what our argument has been. But there was also a secondary argument of people that would say, no, because you gamble, it hurts the integrity of the game. Well, yeah, of course it did. And he is I don't know how penitentially he wasn't really a guy that was showing a lot of penance. He's like, I bet on baseball, and for $1,000 I'll say, yeah, I bet on baseball, Pete Rose, I'll autograph your helmet or your bat. But it was it a fake morality that we went through? Probably, because there was other things going on. But now that there is no morality, and so does Luis Ortiz. Do they throw the book at him and they make an example out of him? Or does MLB go through a thorough investigation and go, yeah, we found other teams have been doing this, and it's been going on for the last couple of years, since now that every outfield is brought to you by FanDuel? And I don't think so. I think it's going to be the former. I think it's going to be they'll throw the book at Ortiz, put him on a gag order, and say that, hey, don't say anything, because we don't want you giving away other players who are going to do this. You just happen to make your the ball that you threw is way too blatant that we couldn't really look away. Because there were even people that were, when that came out, they're like, really? Just two pitches? That's your evidence? Say, yeah, that's pretty damn good evidence if you ask me.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and that's where, again, they were also looking at betting patterns and stuff like that in there. So, like, all these things that, again, that the commissioners of baseball, you know, 100 years ago and up to, you know, Bowie Kuhn and whatever, the things that they were afraid of, far worse things than what they were afraid of, it seems like, are happening on probably a regular basis right now. Like you said, and this is indicative really across sports and society too, that, you know, somebody like Snoop Dogg, that, you know, the only difference between now and when he was at the height of his music career is that today he's a legalized weed dealer as opposed to that. He's sponsoring bowl games and stuff like that. And it's like you've got these entities, whether it be bowl games or whether it be sports leagues or whatever, quote unquote, vices you're talking about. And it comes down to like, oh, well, wait a minute. You didn't tell us how much money was involved in this over the years, which I don't know how the hell they didn't know that. Well, Cosa Nostra could have told them that, right? I mean, generations and generations of Italian guys, you know, working in a certain line of business could have told all these entities how much money that there was in some of the quote-unquote vices. But yeah, I mean, that's where, again, gambling. And again, you know the way it works, Tony. Like, the toothpaste is never going back in the tube. So it's like you could have 1,000 Luis Ortiz stories coming out a day, and it's not going to do anything. What might do something is if it drives down attendance and ratings and whatever in the product enough to where they actually notice it, because it's all a matter of just the bottom line. But these things
I don't know. It's funny, when that came out, I looked at that going, holy cow, this is big. This should be big. And I realized it's probably not going to be big. I don't think the appetite for getting to the bottom of this is as big as the Astro scandal or as the steroid scandal. I just don't see it. And you would think that the aforementioned baseball writers, that, you know, the ones who said that Mo Vaughn is the MVP in 1995 over Albert Bell, those baseball writers, you would think they would be the ones that were that, you know, they browbeat you and they talk about how great Bruce Springsteen is. But they would say that that's an editorial, but but you would think they would be the ones saying, like, I know MLB said we need to investigate, but I don't know. I'm a journalist too. Maybe we should do our own independent investigation, start piecing things together. And it doesn't seem like there's an appetite for it. They announced that they said, we're not going to get into what it is, but Luis Ortiz has been suspended indefinitely, no questions asked. So it's like, well, it's not substance abuse because they would say it. And it's not domestic violence because they would say it. I'm like, it's clearly got to be gambling. And it just, how many weeks ago? Was it 2-3 weeks ago that came out? Haven't heard a peep, really. Haven't heard an appetite of anyone talking about this. Because what that means is, well, if we do this too much, then they may take our gambling away. That our food's going away. So maybe we just stop talking about it. Because at my day job, I work with a lot of guys who, if they're not scrolling through TikTok, they're placing bets. And again, this is something that it boggles my mind of growing up and then getting into sports radio. Even in sports radio, there'd be like an office pool that you would have, or you would play the square game, but it wouldn't be, hey, I have $5 that he's going to throw a strike here. That's insane. But that's going on. It's going on. Well, I was going to say as we speak, but it's the All-Star break. But normally during a game, it's continuing to happen, and it just doesn't seem like there's an appetite for it. Is it because we are living in an age of an inundation of media? And not just like political stuff or anything, but like as far as sports goes, you can the NFL off season doesn't stop. The NFL season continues. It's the off season as we speak, yet it's continuing. There's always something. What's Aaron Rodgers doing? What's Shador Sanders doing? What all these other names that you keep hearing about? NBA, as we do this, is doing their summer league, and there's no shortage of topics. This is usually the time when the ESPYs are going on, and if you know the ESPYs are happening, it's because it's a slow sports week. There's nothing to talk about. No one really cares about baseball at this point. Guys are kind of resting a little bit, and we move on. But we live in the 24/7 digital age, and especially when it comes to sports as a diversion or as a way of life. And people are treating it as a way of life because I may not be able to have my house this month because I spent $2,000 making sure that Mike Trout was going to go 2-for-4 today, and he went 1-for-4, but he got on base because they counted that second one as an error, and I'm screwed. My wife is going to divorce me. It's one of those things that there's so many layers to this that it's not just, oh, he had money on that. He threw a ball and it became a ball. It's not just that. It goes deeper. And I just don't see the appetite right now of people thinking that this is going to will be a bigger problem in the future.
Yeah. And that's where, you know, when you talk about the individualized things like, you know, first pitch, will it be a ball or a strike? What that takes me back to is my aforementioned best friend that, my dad would a lot of times laugh about like his penchant for gambling, like, you know, Richard, that guy would bet on which cockroach would win a race faster. Like, everybody has become my best friend, Jeff. Okay. And everybody has had the ability to do that. Now that's what that's like. Which cockroach is going to win a race faster? Is the first pitch going to be a ball or a strike? Got to get down on it. Got to get some action on it. That's what everybody's mentality is. And part of the way through what you were saying, I had myself convinced that I was ready to make a point when you're talking about the journalism and exposing it and whatever, to like, in a certain way, the worst thing MLB could do is the money grab of like, oh, somebody's going to pay us more than ESPN next year, because nothing's going to make ESPN remember its, you know, former journalistic chops faster than not having any skin in the game with MLB, not being a rights holder anymore, except there's still ESPN bet, and they wouldn't want to do anything to upset the ESPN bet side of the business. So it's like, it's everybody's compromised.
And that gets me to, well, yeah, when you're doing money lines and you're doing all this, and you're like,
yeah,
I remember Jimmy the Greek was on TV before, you know, that it was taboo for Jimmy the Greek to be on TV. That
sly
everybody,
references, sly, yeah, yes.
Yeah, just very subtle references, but you had him on TV. It was like, looks like we're, and you know, but it was quaint for its time. We all knew what was going on, but we all kind of looked the other way because, he's just this gregarious guy who's on CBS.
And later on, Plusberger would do it on the game calls, the sly references.
Yeah, he'd even make those references. And weirdly enough, the team that he was calling games for last, the Raiders, moved to Vegas. Strange how that happens. But then that leads me to another thing you mentioned about ESPN is that, aren't they losing the baseball rights after this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's not official yet. They haven't signed with anybody else yet. There's been speculation that NBC/Peacock now might become the rights holder for that, and that they might move to a year-round, you know, Sunday night fill in the blank for whatever time of the year it is for sports. So that's a possibility, and that's a thing where, again, it would seem like it's in ESPN's best interest to still have some MLB because, again, it's pretty brutal. I mean, how much more college baseball and college softball that nobody really cares about can you cram in during the summer months here? And
or WNBA, because I get, oh, it's Caitlin Clark, it's Angel Reese, but talk to anybody in the non-internet world. Nobody, and I mean nobody, cares about the WNBA.
Right.
You're forcing it down our throat because you're in partnership with the NBA, which has dragged this league along for 30 years.
Right.
It's been operating in the red every year since, but it's just, it looks good. It's basically a tax write-off for them. But you have to put it out there because all these storylines and the, you know, the racial undertones that we have to deal with this. And yet baseball has actual stories. And other than Ohtani or Aaron Judge, they're usually ignored. So what happens?
Sure.
Remember what happened with the NHL, as you know, was on ESPN for a number of years. Gary Thorne was doing the broadcast. It was great. Then all of a sudden, yeah, we lost the rights to him. We don't really care. And then I'm watching the Stanley Cup Finals on Versus,
yeah,
which became the NBC Sports Network or whatever. But like, wait a second, this is the pinnacle. I'm waiting. I think it was the Blackhawks versus Flyers. It was 2010.
Yeah,
and it's on Versus. I don't even know what channel it is. Is it in the thousands? And yet the NHL didn't know how to figure it out. Then they wanted to create their own network, but I don't see really a lot of buzz for the NHL network. And really, the sport has become a very large niche, and which it seems like it's happening with MLB. You don't really see it covered on ESPN. Baseball Tonight, I think, doesn't even exist anymore. So I'm wondering what the future is. That it seems like when Fox had that Fox Baseball Night in America, that they would put it on as just, I guess it's cheaper programming than having, I don't know, reruns of Married with Children or something. Yeah. I don't know.
I guess. And that's the thing, too, where conversely, you're looking at it from the NHL end and their crappy TV deal at the time. ESPN, meanwhile, replaced the NHL at one point in the mid to late 2000s with Arena League Football. And treated that like it was substantially more important. Like they would bury the NHL on SportsCenter and treat the AFL like it was the end-all, be-all. So that just showed you really the corruption on all sides right there, whether it be the sports leagues, whether it be the media outlets covering them, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the thing where, again, wherever baseball ends up, you know, they know that it's in their best interest, you know, from a purely cynical point of view, to have the rights spread out as much as they can between a number of different entities so that they'll all be compromised and can't really call them on the gambling corruption. But again, whether they're on ESPN or not, Disney's still got the casino, so they're not going to be screaming too much about it journalistically as far as what it's doing to the game. And so, yeah, I mean, overall, it just, you know, we've talked about the on-field stuff, and there are some interesting and some great things that are happening as we have, you know, spotlighted here. But in the totality of it, when you're factoring in the off-field stuff and the trajectory of that from a labor standpoint, from a game competitor, game integrity standpoint in terms of the gambling and what that's doing to it, it just, I can't escape this, but, and again, you and I have, I think, you know, larded on a lot of doom and gloom when it comes to that stuff, but I have to say, I think correctly so. It's just, we're just holding up a mirror to what's going on right now.
Yeah. I mean, I love the game. I think there's some like, I mean, Aaron Judge is the kind of superstar that you hate him 'cause he's a Yankee, but you don't hate him. You're like, if he played on any other team, gosh darn it. And there's some really exciting young players, like you mentioned about Pecro Armstrong. Mm-hmm. You had Cal Raleigh, who could be the MVP this year. There's so many really like good young talent.
Paul Skeens, et cetera.
Paul Skeens, yeah. Oh, well, I mean, that gets back to our Pittsburgh conversation because he's not going to be there for long. We all know that. it's just what it's looking forward. And I had you and Ken Mosca on a few months ago talking about this, of what the future is going to be as far as viewing sports. That when I cheekily mentioned the Baseball Network, for folks who don't know, that was a joint partnership with MLB, where they'd be on stations on on ABC and NBC. So you would get local markets that would get games. The problem is they screwed it all up, and the strike push, it was right after the 94 All-Star game, but what it was, NBC would get the both league championship series, and ABC would get the division series and the World Series, and they would trade off every year. Remember, this is pre-internet, pre-streaming and all that. So,
and regionalized, you could only watch one LCS at a time. That was stupid.
Yeah, it was dumb. And sometimes you were not seeing your team, that they were delaying certain things, and it was a mess. And then they scrapped it after 1995. So that was why the 95 World Series, I think the first two games were on ABC, and then it was on NBC, and then ABC. I think even Al Michaels made a joke by saying, we can't tell you what network the next game will be on, but I think I just saw Bob Costas and Joe Morgan getting off the bus. But what happened, a lot of that became because CBS, prior to the Baseball Network, had the baseball rights, and they screwed it up. They hated, by the way, they hated Jack Buck. They thought he was a dope, that he didn't pay attention to any other team besides the Cardinals, didn't really know enough about the players. And so they kicked him off and put Sean McDonough in that position in 92 and 93 World Series. But CBS paid a boatload, never came close to, which is why CBS has never had baseball since then.
Right.
And then because of that, Fox jumped in, and then they got the rights, and they still have the rights to this day. But that was baseball viewing. And at one time it was, well, wait a second, how are we going to view this? Because you don't want to put things on cable. Not everyone has cable. That was the big controversy with Monday Night Football, by saying, oh, no, see, we're going to put Monday Night Football on ESPN. They're like, wait, what? It was always on network TV. Not everybody has ESPN. And they said, well, too bad. Go get a cable box, stupid.
Right.
And now we're getting to a point where not only do you need streaming services, you need specific ones. You need Peacock. Well, I don't watch NBC. I don't really care that much. What am I going to watch? Old Friends episodes? Different world? No, what are you going to do? And it's like, you have to get Peacock to watch this game. And you're finding out that certain bars don't have that kind of money to be paying for Amazon Prime and for Peacock and for Hulu and for Netflix and for this and this and this. They're like, I can't do it. We don't have the game tonight.
Right.
And it's causing a disaster for the local, for different, whether it's a local economy or you want to watch the big Thursday night game. I was in last year was the day Otani had the 50-50 game. I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I went to a bar. And the only way we could watch Thursday night football was a small, like 25-inch TV that was behind the bar if you wanted to watch it. Otherwise, it's like fishing shows on some cable channel.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm concerned about, is are we going to get to a point where you're going to have to be up to it on all the streaming services if you even want to watch this? And I think a lot of people say, yeah, it's not even worth the effort anymore.
Yeah, and that's something definitely worth keeping an eye on if the ESPN rights end up going to a streaming service here. My guess at the present time is that it'll just be NBC diverting some of what they're probably going to be buying to Peacock, much like what they're going to do with the NBA, because Ben Chu and I have talked about this on the show extensively, that like the NBA is going to do that to a certain extent and try and use it to boost Peacock, but they're going to keep the prime games they have for themselves on there to try to, you know, boost ratings and try to basically sort of bring back the feeling from the 90s, which is what they're hoping to do with that. But regardless of whether the state of baseball, again, like I said, there are some things to point out that are exciting and that are positive that are going on. We've spotlighted that and a whole bunch of stuff to the contrary right now. But whatever the state of baseball and the way things are going, it is always great to be able to break things down with you, Tony Mazur. Really appreciate you being here today. And again, certainly Everybody should be going and checking out the Check Your Brain podcast with Tony Mazur. And again, think about going for the Patreon one here, because you do get some extras on there, some things that you won't get elsewhere. But again, always great to be able to break down these things with you, Tony. Thank you so much for being back on the show with me today.
Yeah, thank you. I know it was a lot of, like you said, doom and gloom with talking about it, but it's we're not negative. We're being realists.
That
from gambling to the streaming options to just the integrity of the game, that if you're just going to put your head in the sand and talk about statistics, it's like, yeah, there's a little more to it. And when you do a long form podcast, that you really need to start digging into these things as opposed to just going like, well, he's hitting 325. Okay, well, but there's a little bit more to that than if we're just going to do. If you want that, there's sports talk radio. There's sports talk radio to do that very low IQ stuff. We try to keep the IQ level at like 95 at least.
at a bare minimum anyways. And also, and for more baseball coverage here, go check out on the main page at fantasydrafthelp.com the 2025 FDH MLB midseason breakdown. So we've got that from more of a statistical point of view than some of the things we were talking about here today. So go check that out and see the strengths and weaknesses of the contenders, the pretenders, and everyone in between on that there. So again, thank you so much, Tony Mazur, and thank you everybody for checking out FDH Lounge mini episode 1845.